I want to begin tonight with an introduction to our study. And I want to just remind you that in Esther chapter 5, Haman wanted to kill Mordecai. He found out that he was a Jew, and he also was objecting to Mordecai because Mordecai was refusing to bow down and honor Haman. So as a result, Haman wants to eliminate Mordecai and all the Jews, because his strategy to getting rid of Mordecai would be to kill all the Jews, and in the process then he gets rid of Mordecai, as opposed to just targeting Mordecai directly. And then in Esther chapter 6, the king could not sleep. And so he ended up reading some old records of the Medo-Persian Empire, and he found out that Mordecai told him about a plot to kill the king, and the king then killed the two individuals, and Mordecai had not yet been honored. And so what we saw in our last study in chapter 6 is that as the king is having these records read, he realizes that Mordecai has not been honored for saving his life. So the king then is planning, he's strategizing as how to honor Mordecai. Haman's coming in. He's now gotten up the boldness to specifically ask that Mordecai be hung, be killed. So Haman's walking into the king, into the palace, with the intent to ask the king to kill Mordecai. And the king is looking for somebody to honor Mordecai. Exactly the flip opposite of what Haman wants. The king is told that Haman's coming in, so then he asks Haman, what would Haman recommend to honor somebody that the king wants to honor? And if you recall, then Haman, he thinks it's for himself. And so he has this great recommendation. Put him on a horse, put a robe on him, put a crown on him, and have somebody lead him through the city, announcing to everybody the honor of the individual that's on the horse. Only Haman finds out that it's going to be Mordecai that's going to get the honor. This is not exactly what he had in mind. This is actually the opposite of what he wanted. And so he's really upset. So he goes off and he does it because the king tells him he better not be short in anything that he had recommended. And so when he gets done, he goes home. He talks to his wife. He gets some friends over. He tells them what happened. And before he can get done, chapter 6, verse 14 tells us this. And while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet which Esther had prepared. Now, what we saw in chapter 5 is that Esther had already invited them to a banquet. We call it the first banquet. And when they got to the banquet, and the question is, who got to the banquet? It was the king and Haman. The king and Haman came to the banquet, and when the king asked the queen, that is Queen Esther, what it was she wanted, she said, I want you to come to my next banquet, banquet number 2. And so that's the way we ended our study last time. So when we come to chapter 7, this is the second banquet, and the king and Haman are coming to the second banquet. And Haman has just gotten through honoring Mordecai, and so that's the setting. The tension is here. Verse 1, chapter 7. And now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. So they show up. Esther's there. I have to admit, I would really like to know exactly what was on the banquet's menu. I would like to know what Esther had prepared for these men. Most of us, when we think of food, we think of fancy things. Wouldn't it be interesting to know what did a queen in those days offer people who came to her banquet? What we discover is that there's wine in verse 1, but was there anything else? Well, you know there was. I have to admit, I'm curious as to what else was offered at the banquet, verse 2. And the king said to Esther on the second day. Now you say second day. Second day of what? Well, if you go back to Esther chapter 5, verse 8, you find out that the first banquet is on one day, and then she invites them to the second banquet on the second day. So when it says second day, this is the second day, this is the second banquet. This is not like 2 days in the banquet, this is just the second day. So first day was in chapter 5, And so we're told, and also they drank their wine at the banquet. What is your petition, Queen Esther? So the king asked the queen, what's your petition? It shall be granted to you, and what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be done. Now we made the point in our last study that this was typical of Persian kings. And even we saw in the Gospels where Herod offers half of his kingdom to his daughter. So this appears to be nothing more than just hyperbole. I give you half the kingdom. I mean, it's a gracious, it's excessive, it's over the top. The basic message is I'll give you basically whatever you want. I would seriously doubt that he would give up literally half of his kingdom to the queen. In fact, most Bible scholars agree. But the point is that the king asked her, what does she want? Verse 3. And then the queen, Esther, replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request. She says, here's my request. Give me my life and give me the life of my people. If you're the king, and you hear this request, I would like you to spare my life and save my people. I think that would be a shock if this is the first time you heard it. It's the first time the king heard it. That's her request. Spare my life, spare my people. Verse 4, for we have been sold, and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. So she says, my people are to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. I think she said that last time. I keep reacting to this idea, destroyed and killed and annihilated. I guess that's varying degrees of dying. I mean, once you're destroyed, I don't think you need to be killed. And once you're killed, I don't think you need to be annihilated. She's really making the point, destroyed, killed, annihilated. We've been sold for this purpose. Now, when she says sold, you might say, well, what does she mean by sold? Well, do you remember that Haman told the king that there was this really evil people in the kingdom and they didn't obey his laws and they were rebellious and, oh, by the way, we need to eliminate them in the process. What I will do is I'll put 10,000 talents of silver in the treasury of the kingdom. Remember that? We discovered that somebody did a calculation. They figured out that was 375 tons of silver. That's a lot of silver. And someone did a calculation and figured out that was 2/3 of the income of the Medo-Persian Empire during the reign of Xerxes I, or King Ahasuerus. We've already made the point that those two names are interchangeable. Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name, Xerxes is the Greek name. So there's a lot of money. And I suspect that money was a major factor in the king agreeing to kill these people. I mean, it was a spoils of the kill, if you put it that way. Kill the people, take all their possessions. And I'm sure Haman was going to put some in his pocket along the way and give the rest of it to the king. And so when she says sold, I suspect that she's thinking about this. How would you feel if an edict went out to kill all the Jews, and then you found out that there was this financial deal that was going to go on, that somehow the king was going to get money off of your people, how would you feel? How would you feel if here in the United States there was some edict that came out, politicians let it be known that a certain segment of our population was going to be murdered or killed, and then some weeks later, through the rumor mill, you found out that there was really a financial deal connected to this thing. How would you feel? Bad news, right? Well, I think that's what's going on. The Jews are really upset. The queen knows about it. This is really bad. And she says, before we have been sold, she's right, I and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. For if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance of the king. So now what she's saying in the last part of this verse is a little bit difficult to understand because Hebrew text is a little difficult. And so what I did is I put the verse on the screen. The first part of it, she says, "For we have been sold and my people to be destroyed and to be killed and to be annihilated." This is the ESV on the screen. And the ESV, I think, has done an excellent job of translating what the Hebrew probably really was trying to say. If we had been sold merely as slaves, she's saying, look, if it had been that we were just sold as slaves, that'd be okay. You want to destroy us, and that's bad, but if you weren't to just sell us as slaves, that's a different ballgame. And why? Because I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with a loss. What's the loss? Money to the king. So she's basically saying, you know, we wouldn't want the king to lose his money. We'd been sold as slaves, okay, fine. But we have a sentence of death, and that's not okay. I think that's what she's trying to say in verse 4. In verse 5, then the king, we're told, asked Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this? I wonder if Haman at this point is aware as to what she's talking about. I think Haman, his mind is racing quickly, and I suspect he's put the dots together. Some people have made the suggestion that Haman's probably clueless. I don't think so. I think Haman's a very smart man. And I think Haman already understands exactly what she is talking about. And can you just imagine all of a sudden the emotional tension that he's under? And can you imagine the emotional tension that she's under? And here's this clueless king. He's sitting there and saying, like, who is this and what is this? And like, he's confused. But all he knows is this is his queen. And we saw already that he loves her more than what? All of the other women, right? I mean, he's got his queen sitting there. You can just imagine. She was the most beautiful of all the ladies. You can imagine he's sitting there looking at this beautiful queen of his. You're going to be destroyed? Your people? The fact that he asked the who, and he asked the where, and who would presume to do this, means that he hasn't got it yet. If he had understood, he would have known it was Haman, and he would have known exactly what's going on. The king does not really understand yet in verse 5 what's happening. Verse 6, and Esther said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. Whoa, can you imagine how Haman felt at that moment? Boy, his heart must have sunk down to his toes, all the way down. This is bad news. And then Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. That was a bold move on the part of the queen. I wonder if the queen said it softly or strong. I said it strong. I wonder if maybe she said, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. I wonder how she did it. Or was she just bold? Well, when the word Haman came out, Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. As I was thinking about what she did, I was thinking about the whole issue of self-defense. Have you ever thought about self-defense as a Christian? Is it right for a Christian to defend themselves? This is somewhat of a digression from our study, but as I was thinking about what she did, I think it's a topic that we don't talk about very often as Christians, so indulge me for a few minutes as we talk about self-defense for Christians. What she did is she defended herself, right? She defended her people. But is it right for a Christian to defend themselves in a stronger way, with more forceful action? That is like using weapons. Turn to Matthew chapter 26, verse 52, if you would. I want to cover a couple points and we'll come back to our study. Matthew 26, verse 52. This is a passage that I'm sure that you heard a lot about. In this passage, we're told, then Jesus said to them, put your sword back into its place, for all those who take up the sword shall perish by the sword. Pacifists tell us that, well, this is a reason why you should not defend yourself. If you defend yourself with a gun, with a knife, with a sword, with whatever, you know, you're going to die by that. You see, Jesus is telling us that we're not supposed to defend ourselves as the way they would argue it. Well, that's an interesting argument. Turn to Matthew 5:9. This would be another statement in support of those who are pacifists. Matthew 5:9 says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God." What does that tell us Christians should be? Peacemakers. In Romans chapter 12, we're told that as far as you're able, you're to be at peace with how many people? All people. We're to be at peace with all people, as much as we can. But there comes a time when you can't. There comes a time when it's just impossible, because somebody doesn't want to be at peace with you, that they box you into a corner. You have no choice. Turn to Luke 22, verse 35. Luke 22, 35 says, "And he said to them, when I sent you out without money, belt and bag and sandals, you did not lack anything, did you? And they said, no, nothing. And he said to them, but now, whoever has a money belt is to take it along, and likewise also a bag, and whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and do what? Buy one." In verse 35, Jesus says, I told you once before to go out and don't take anything with you. This time, when you go out, take along some money, take along a bag, and oh, by the way, if you don't have a sword, sell your coat and go buy a sword. Now, why do you think Jesus told his disciples to go buy a sword if they're not supposed to use a sword? I guess you just stick it on like an ornament, like a wedding ring, right? Hey, see, my latest, neatest, great sword is, you know, it's gold, silver, you know, it's really a cool sword. I mean, don't touch it, you know, don't do anything with it, but it's really a neat sword. Is that what Jesus had in mind? I don't think so. Jesus tells them to go buy a sword, and the obvious implication is to go use it. Look at Psalm chapter 144, verse 1. That means that you can run out and buy a gun. Oh, buy a gun? Well, if you can buy a sword, you can also buy a gun. Psalm 144, verse 1, David is speaking. He says, "Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for peace." Is that what he says? That's not what he said. "Who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle." That's what he says. And who does he give the credit to? God. And it's written in Scripture by the Holy Spirit. The message is, it's okay to go to war. It's okay to kill. It's okay to use your fingers, be it on a knife or a gun or whatever it might be. Look at Proverbs chapter 14, verse 6. This talks about there comes a time when it's wise to protect yourself. Proverbs chapter 14, verse 16 says, "A wise man is cautious and turns away from evil, but a fool is arrogant and careless." What's the message? Well, the message is that when a wise man sees evil, what does he do? He runs. He turns from it. But a fool is arrogant and careless. The idea is that they don't. I just hang around, you know, God's going to protect me. No, wait a minute. Proverbs says run. Proverbs says protect yourself. Look at Proverbs 22, verse 3. You already got the wisdom from God. He says if you see trouble, avoid it. Proverbs 22, verse 3 says, "The prudent sees the evil and hides himself. But the naive, they go on and are punished for it." So there's two proverbs that tell you that when you see trouble, what do? You protect yourself. You don't just blindly proceed towards something that's going to harm you. Watch this. It's right for us to protect ourselves. It's right for us to protect ourselves. This becomes an issue. This is another digression on a digression, I guess, is that when you end up with a marital situation where you have one spouse beating up on another one, physical violence, emotional abuse is bad. Physical abuse is even worse. Although I'm not sure that there's much difference, but
But clearly, physical abuse is really serious. And what both of these Proverbs tell you to do is that there's time to escape. Not divorce, doesn't argue for divorce, but at least escape. Okay. Look at Ezekiel chapter 33, verse 6. We're almost done with this digression. It says, "But if the watchman sees the sword coming and does not blow the trumpet, and the people are not warned, and the sword comes and takes a person from them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood I will require from the watchman's hand." What's the message? When the watchman sees trouble coming, what's he supposed to do? Blow a trumpet. And so why? So the people can escape. Verse 7. "And now as for you, son of man, I have appointed you a watchman for the house of Israel, so you will hear a message from my mouth and give them warning from me. And when I say to the wicked man, 'You will surely die,' and you do not speak to warn the wicked man of his way, and the wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require from your hand." So it goes on to basically the idea of warning people. And the last verse I want you to look at is Exodus chapter 22, verse 2. This will help, I think, solidify our points. Exodus 22, verse 2 is about a thief. In fact, the whole chapter is about property rights, things that we are entitled to. Verse 1 talks about if a man steals an ox or a sheep, but verse 2 is what I want you to look at. "If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account." The message is that if you have a thief coming in at night, you know, it's dark, and you happen to kill him as he's coming in trying to protect yourself, then you're not going to be liable for killing the man. What's that translate to? Self-protection. Verse 3 is interesting. The basic message is that, but if the sun's up, then there's no justification for killing him. Why? Because now you know who he is and you see where he's at, and there shouldn't be an accidental clubbing him in such a way that he ends up dying. But the basic point of the two verses is that you have the right for self-defense. So what did Esther do? Esther defended herself. She did not have to use a weapon. She used her mouth. She went to the king. She appealed to the king. And Haman is terrified. Maybe the old proverbial, his knees are knocking, the hands are trembling, he's having difficulty thinking. What happens to you when you get upset? You have difficulty thinking? Verse 7. When we come to verse 7 now, Haman is in trouble and he's going to end up getting hanged. "And the king arose in his anger from the drinking wine and went into the palace garden." The king gets up. He hears that it's Haman. What does he do? He gets up and he walks away. He goes into the palace garden. Now, that's a good thing. I don't know if the king is trying to exercise self-control, or if he wants time to think, or if he's just so emotionally upset he just escapes. Not sure which. Some people I know that when they get really upset, they have learned to zip their lip and walk out and get calm. Other people just let go and they explode. But this king gets up and leaves, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. For he saw that harm had been determined against him by the king. Oh, wow. King gets up, he walks out. Haman must be used to the king's behavior. Because when he sees the king leave, he knows that he's in trouble. Listen to Proverbs 16:14. I'll just read it quick. Proverbs 16:14 says, "The fury of a king is like messengers of death, but a wise man will appease it." And listen to Proverbs chapter 20, verse 2. It says, "The terror of a king is like the growling of a lion, and he who provokes him to anger forfeits his own life." That's Haman. Haman is going to forfeit his own life. Verse 8. "And now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine," someplace in the palace, "Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was." Bad deal. That is not smart. "And the king said, Will he even assault the queen with me in the house? And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, from what we understand, that was fairly common in the Medo-Persian Empire. If the man was going to die or the woman was going to die, they came up and they put a bag on your head. And then they hauled you out. And apparently, the word, it was a command to put the bag on his head. I mean, can you imagine what's going on with Haman at that point? I wonder how Queen Esther is responding. Isn't it interesting that Queen Esther does not beg for his life? Think about that. Today, we as Christians, we would say, oh, forgive him. Queen Esther makes no appeal for his life. Why? It's called self-defense. It was his intent to murder an entire race. He's a wicked man. And the king, he sees Haman falling on the couch, probably all studded with gold and silver. Check that out from chapter 1. Haman's in trouble. You know what Haman's doing? He's desperately pleading, and I suspect the queen's not responding, so he ends up in the process of pleading on the couch. And the fact that the king would draw the conclusion that he means something bad, I suspect sexual, tells you something about the moral culture of the time. Even assault the queen while the king is there. No morals at all. The king sees this. He concludes that Haman is doing this. So Haman's life is troubled. Verse 9. And then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai. The king finds out that there was this gallows made by Haman for Mordecai. I suspect that made him even angrier. Who spoke good on behalf of the king. He says, now remember, Mordecai, he saved your neck. He saved your life. And the king said, hang him on it. I suspect the king is absolutely enraged. Just kill the guy. Verse 10, and so they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Doesn't get calm until after Haman is dead. Chapter 8, verse 1. On that day, King Ahasuerus gave the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Isn't that interesting? Haman, the enemy of the Jews. Think about the fact that he was an Agagite. We've made that point before. There was this feud between the Jews and the Amalekites. Remember, the Agagites were the descendant of the royal line of the Amalekites. And Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had disclosed what he was to her. So finally, Esther reveals that there's this relationship that she has with Mordecai. Verse 2. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman. So the king gives Haman's house to Esther, and Esther then makes Mordecai the person in charge of the house. Verse 3. And then Esther spoke again to the king, fell at his feet, wept, and implored him to avert the evil scheme of Haman the Agagite and his plot which he had devised against the Jews. The king extended the golden scepter to Esther, and so Esther arose and stood before the king. So Esther realizes that there's still a problem. And what's the problem? There's this decree that's been released to the entire kingdom, all 127 provinces, satraps, and the decree is that on the 12th month, all the Jews are to be, what? Destroyed and killed and annihilated. That was Esther's words, right? And that's still out there. I mean, Haman's gone, that's good, but the decree is still there. That's a problem. And so she goes into the king and see what's going to happen. Now, if you remember, the Medo-Persian custom of the time was that once a king made an official decree in the empire, is that the decree could not be revoked. So the decree is in place permanently. It can't be undone. So there's a huge problem here. Verse 5. And then she said, if it pleases the king, and if I have found favor before him, and the matter seems proper to the king, and I am pleasing in his sight. Let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, which he wrote to destroy the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the calamity which will befall my people, and how can I endure to see the destruction of my kindred? So King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, Behold, I have given the house of Haman to Esther and him who hanged on the gallows because he had stretched out his hand against the Jews. Now, verse 8, Now you write to the Jews as you see fit, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with the king's signet ring cannot be revoked. What does the king say? She's asked that it be revoked. What does the king say? It can't be. So what's the solution? He's going to give the ring to Esther and Mordecai, and he's saying, go do what you want. Here's the ring. Go do it. Whatever it is you want to do. It's amazing how loose he is with his ring. He just gives his ring to Haman to do whatever he wants. Now he gives the ring to Esther and Mordecai for them to do whatever they want. I mean, he throws his ring around. It has a lot of authority. Verse 9. And so the king's scribes were called at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces, which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, and to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. And he wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. So the message is that the messages are going out by horses. What history tells us is that the Medo-Persians had this great Pony Express mail delivery. So that's what's being described here. Verse 11, And in them the king granted the Jews who were in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend themselves, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. Isn't that interesting? They really loved triple descriptions. To destroy and to kill and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. The tables are flipped. So all of a sudden, the Jews have permission to do what? To defend themselves and to destroy the armies of any provinces and to take the spoils. Put money in their pocket. Verse 12, And on one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month Adar, a copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the people so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. And the couriers hastened and impelled by the king's command went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. So the message is, it was given out in the capital. It was given out throughout the entire kingdom. This is incredible. So what happened? Two opposing decrees. Two opposing decrees. A decree to kill all the Jews, and another decree to save the Jews. A decree to eliminate, to annihilate all of the Jews, and another decree that says you can save yourself. What did I just describe? There's a truth about the whole issue of salvation. What happened when Adam ate of a tree in the garden in Genesis chapter 3? When he ate, he sinned. He broke God's law. In chapter 2, God said that in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. And we know from Romans chapter 3, verse 23, that for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And then Romans chapter 6, verse 23 says, for the wages of sin is what? Death. You know what God did in Genesis? He has made a decree that if Adam would violate his command, that he and, it turns out, the whole human race would die. Watch this. To kill, to destroy, and to annihilate. For us, it was physical death. It was spiritual death. The reason that first decree had to be in place was because God's a holy God. He has a standard. And if he would violate that standard, then he's not a holy God anymore. That decree can't be revoked. Can't be undone. So you know what God did? God made another decree. And it's in opposition to that decree. And that decree was that Jesus would come and die on a cross so we could have our sins forgiven. And by simple faith, by believing, he did all the work for us that we could be labeled what? Righteous. And get eternal life. Isn't that interesting? The illustration that comes out of this chapter. Two opposing decrees. It has an application for us when it comes to spiritual life. Look at verse 15 now. Wrap up the chapter. And then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of the linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city, and wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. What happened? Watch this. Haman's decree brought what? Sadness and mourning and sorrow. What did the second decree bring? Gladness and joy and rejoicing. God's first decree brought what? Sadness and sorrow. And the decree of salvation? Gladness and joy and happiness. I mean, there's a great parallel here in this chapter to our faith, to what God has done in our own life. Well, that's our study for tonight. So next time, same book, same place, and we'll see the exciting conclusion of our study. Let's pray.